Before I begin, I must thank the Onassis Foundation for inviting me to be part of this wonderful project, Scarsopoli. And now I have just one slide to put up on the screen, please. And it is only marginally related to my paper. Is this slide coming? Good. I hope you will accept this slide as a pleasant alternative to a very large image of me. I'd like to start my presentation with a disclosure. At first for fun, but then with the seriousness of an archivist, I've been collecting examples of the uses of the figure of Socrates in North American popular media, reaching back as far as I can get, right up to today. By popular media, I mean such things as fiction, journalism, visual arts, theater, political advocacy, education, radio, television, music, comedy, and more. My collection is eclectic, and I am now examining it for patterns over issues of national security, Cold War orthodoxies, and McCarthyism. Creative artists develop distinctive interpretations of Socrates as oblique contributions to the raging political controversies, and in so doing, helped inaugurate the widespread use of Socrates as a popular symbol of the ideals of democracy. In my paper, I examine three of these examples at length. A 1951 Broadway play called Barefoot in Athens, a 1952 Toronto play called Simply Socrates, and a 1953 episode on the death of Socrates for the popular US television series, You Are There. With my time today, I'd like to address just the 1953 television program. Better? But I must first construct a little context. Before the Second World War, Socrates had no standing as a popular democratic hero. That was Pericles' territory. For example, the eminent American jurist, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, turned to Pericles, not to Socrates, to work out his reasoning in a landmark free speech case decided in 1927. In his widely cited published opinion, Brandeis explicitly drew on a reading of the Periclean funeral oration to argue that bold speech and civic courage are essential for the health of democratic government, and that American political life must encourage the development of such personal character traits among citizens. This opinion introduced into US jurisprudence the idea that courageous speech is necessary for the practice of self-government. The first indication of Socrates' potential appeal as a democratic hero can be found in John Steinbeck's The Moon is Down, a short novel written during the war when Steinbeck was serving in the US Foreign Information Service, a precursor of both the CIA and the Voice of America. And the book was explicitly designed to exalt and encourage the resistance movements in occupied Europe. Published in March 1942, just 3 months after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the book sold more than 500,000 copies within a few weeks. Later that same year, a stage adaptation played to packed houses on Broadway, a major film adaptation followed within the year, and after the war, it was revealed that the book had been widely read throughout Europe during the war, having been smuggled into occupied lands, secretly translated, copied, and circulated. The story in The Moon is Down details the swift invasion of a small coal mining town in an unnamed northern European country by the forces of an unnamed nation at war with England and Russia, and how the townspeople undertake increasingly bold resistance work. The story's tone is relentlessly optimistic, as is appropriate to a propaganda piece. Free people will prevail over those who follow orders and act as part of a herd. Strikingly, the final chapter features a sustained recollection of Socrates performed by the main character. In the closing scene of the novel, the hero, Mayor Orden, has been found out by the occupying authority and faces execution. While waiting for the sentence to be carried out, Mayor Orden speaks with a friend. He wonders aloud about whether he should regret his resistance work, since it's cost him his life. To answer himself, Orden searches his memory for schoolboy lessons of Socrates. Of course, Socrates would not greedily cling to mere life, but would always choose to do the right thing. To muster up some courage in the face of death, he recalls his boyhood performance of Socrates' speeches for a school event. "I had courage then. I was Socrates," he says. The novel and the play close with Mayor Orden reciting Socrates' last words to his friend. "Crito, I owe a rooster to Asclepius. Will you remember to pay the debt?" And of course, his friend responds, "The debt will be paid." Now, while the film version of The Moon is Down leaves out the mention of the debt to Asclepius, it adds a scene that interprets Steinbeck's inclusion of Plato's account of Socrates' final words. The film closes with Mayor Orden walking to the gallows. As he dies, a furious explosion erupts in town. The remaining resistant fighters have blown up the coal mine. His execution has not silenced resistance, but indeed has emboldened it. Steinbeck calls upon only a slice of the story of Socrates available in the ancient sources, Plato's depiction of his last days. The propagandistic purpose of The Moon is Down could not, of course, tolerate any trace of Xenophon's suggestion that Socrates might actually be suicidal, or of the pedant we find in the clouds of Aristophanes. In the immediate post-war period, fear of communist influence in domestic affairs gripped US politics. Legislators and public opinion considered communism in all forms so sinister and dangerous that democratic procedures could be suspended in the effort to combat it. Reckless accusations, investigations, and blacklists flourished. And in this context, interest in Socrates spikes. The episode on the death of Socrates on the television program You Are There is a fine example of how and why this was so. In 1953, CBS television saw, I'm going to give you a little context about what this show was like, how it was structured. In 1953, CBS television sought to adapt a hit program on its affiliated radio station that was recreating historical events from around the world as if they were breaking news stories. They enlisted a young Walter Cronkite to star as the news anchor of each program. And of course, Walter Cronkite went on to be a giant of American television journalism and was widely regarded as the most trusted man in America for many years. Now, unknown to Cronkite and the CBS officials at the time, the producer and director of the series secretly employed three blacklisted Hollywood screenwriters to write the scripts. These writers relied on imposters to deliver their scripts to CBS and to pretend to be the writers in meetings with the station managers. The writers found the format presented a huge opportunity. History, this is the format, the notion of recreating a historical event, presented them with a tremendous political opportunity. "History," one of the writers later recalled in an interview, "could serve us well." He continued, "We had no need to invent conflicts to serve our purposes. They were there for the taking, and we happily took them. In that shameful time of McCarthyite terror," he continues, "of know-nothing attempts to deform and defile history, to kill any kind of dissent, we were able to do shows about civil liberties, civil rights, and artistic freedom. Accordingly," end quote. Accordingly, writers chose subjects such as Joan of Arc and the Trial of Galileo. And as one writer put it in an interview in 1970, this show was, quote, "probably the only place where any guerrilla warfare against McCarthy was conducted in a public medium. Now, the episode on the death of Socrates is widely considered to be You Are There's best show, owing to the sheer quality of the writing. But it was also the one that most intensely resonated with contemporary politics, and as a result, it was also its most memorable episode, the one people involved with the show return to in interviews and discuss at length. Cronkite explained in a 2003 interview on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the show that the people involved with the making of the You Are There programs found history, quote, rich with striking parallels for thinking about dissent and intellectual freedom, and that stunningly, the farther back in time we went, the more contemporary the parallels became. Cronkite singled out the episode about Socrates. Quote, Socrates was the perfect hero for the 1950s, not only because he effectively engaged the free speech issue, but mostly because he did not back down. Now, the appeal of the You Are There show was its claim to provide audiences with an accurate account of notable episodes from history based on primary sources through the device of imaginary live interviews by known reporters with key figures from history. The producer made this clear to all. Every episode was to be a dramatic recreation of a specific personal moment in history, authentic and specific, no speculation. How about that to approach to your sources? To help create the show's aura of historical authenticity, the producer set up a strong visual illusion to Cronkite's enormously successful news coverage of the 1952 National Political Conventions live from a newscaster's box in the convention hall. That was an innovation during the nominating conventions for Eisenhower and Stevenson. On You Are There, Cronkite appeared on camera only from behind a desk at the start and end of each episode. To get around the potentially tricky problem for a visual medium of having 20th century reporters interact with historical figures, for example, should they put the reporters in period costume? Correspondents conducted their fictionalized interviews as off-camera voices. The show opened each week with a booming voice declaring, "All things are as they were then, except you are there." And Cronkite's closing tagline stressed the importance of turning to historical events to inform reflection on contemporary matters. What sort of day was it? A day like all days, filled with the events that alter and illuminate our times, and you were there. Cronkite says in one interview that that is the line he is most often asked to repeat by people who meet him on the street. The art direction of the show also aroused a feeling of sort of historical authenticity, though it did so by activating the viewer's notions of historicity and not by presenting a scholarly recreation of the setting. In the important death scene, for example, the costumes, the positioning of the actors around a couch, and the gestures performed by all the actors vividly recall the well-known Jacques-Louis David painting of 1787, The Death of Socrates. My slide. The show's studied effort to present a meticulously researched product worked with the choice of subject matter subtly to ridicule McCarthy's practice of promulgating reckless, unsubstantiated accusations. The script packs a number of references culled indiscriminately from Xenophon, Aristophanes, Plato, and Plutarch into this half-hour-long program. The You Are There show manages to convey the tremendous controversy in the sources over the meaning of Socrates. We see the irritating intellectual that Aristophanes clouds pokes fun at. We witness an expression of the public sentiment that he might be a genuinely dangerous influence in the city. We are able to consider the impiety charge is an unsubstantiated lie concocted as a part of a plot to circumvent the amnesty in place after the conclusion of the Peloponnesian War, and thus illegally attack Socrates for his past associations with now disgraced politicians like Critias? Even evidence of regret on the part of the Athenians after the execution finds expression in this production. The controversy that Socrates sparked in his own day is front and center in this show. In the opening scene, a group that includes Aristophanes and Plato waits for news of the verdict. The scene includes an exchange between an off-camera correspondent and Aristophanes that is remarkable for its ironic allusion to the blacklist. The reporter asks Aristophanes whether his plays give credence to the accusations against Socrates, as some have suggested. And Aristophanes tells the reporter, "The politicians blame us artists when it is a group of stupid men who have managed to get the city into this predicament." He continues directly into the camera, "It was only a play." In the ancient sources, it is Socrates himself, of course, who suggests that Aristophanes' comedy, The Clouds, can be viewed as his earliest accuser. The show proceeds to portray Socrates in prison, calmly examining his companions' beliefs regarding current situation, that is, his unjust conviction, impending execution, refusal to flee. And it shows his capacity, even now, to be a good philosophical interlocutor, good friend, family man, and civic benefactor. This is followed by a somber depiction of the administration of the hemlock, moderated only by illustrations of Socrates' own legendary cheerfulness in the face of death. This presentation of Socrates elicits feelings of loss, remorse, and regret. The show's creative team successfully uses Socrates to focus attention on how abuses of democratic authority can be difficult to curtail, can enfeeble democratic discourse, and can perpetrate injustices on individual citizens. The show challenges viewers to see a parallel to their own time and to recognize that McCarthyism is damaging the polity as well as victimizing individuals. As a whole, the episode presents the prosecution of Socrates as illustrative of a pathology that can infect democracy, or of the capacity of an admirable, even exemplary city to blunder badly. Cronkite's concluding comments as anchor suggest that this is precisely what the creative team was going for. He speaks of the enduring symbolic import of the cup of poison as a test and symbol of a gap between the principles and actions that will last in the public memory, activating grief and sorrow and initiating painful examinations in the years to come. The contemporary parallel was palpable. McCarthyism would, Cronkite predicted, be America's cup of poison. And he was, of course, right. So let me say, in conclusion, that I hope this case study has illuminated how and why particular figures from Greek antiquity occasionally become part of the modern popular vernacular. And that it has, to some extent, clarified the role of the iconic figure as a means of transmission and reinvention of the classical past. Thank you.